Welcome to episode 3 of Techish Podcast with yours truly, Abadesi of Hustle Crew.
And me, Michael Behane, of peopleofcolorintech.com.
Michael, I'm going to make you so happy right now.
Go on, shoot.
I've watched Black Panther.
Done, no.
About Black time. Panther forever!
I was going to bring it up straight away.
I know you were. That's why I was like, I'm just going to preempt this and be like, I've seen it.
We actually got a few tweets of people saying, like, I can't believe it. Like,
I was
ashamed. People saying that we can't wait for them to discuss it in this episode, so... No pressure.
No pressure.
What did you think?
Obviously, I loved it. I loved every second of it. I wanted to, as soon as it was over, I wanted to watch it again. I thought the stunts in it were amazing.
The stunts? Like, which bits?
The car chase in Korea.
Dope. Yeah.
I was just like, what? That was crazy. And then the soundtrack was obviously fire. That
soundtrack
was amazing.
It was the shit.
The acting, the dancing, the costumes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved all of it. I also loved that the head of their technology lab
was a
woman. That was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was good. It was a good film. It really made me want to go back to Africa.
Go, why not?
I will. Watch me go. I'm going now. Bye. And what I also loved was the scene, like, where, I mean, it happened more than once, but where they do that ritual and, like, meet their ancestors.
That was dope.
That was so good. And, you know, it reminded me of how, like, in African culture, particularly when I was growing up, you know, my dad's like Nigerian people are very religious. And you always have like two religions in Africa because you have your church and then you have like your traditional stuff.
Yeah.
And like your traditional stuff is like so much a part of your culture.
It's still quite ingrained in Nigeria.
It's so ingrained. You know, my name, for example, my surname is Osunsade and it's actually pronounced Osunshade. And the myth of my family is that there was a woman with her husband and she couldn't get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like praying to the gods, like Orison's like famous god. And so the god was like, you have to go to this waterfall, the Orison waterfall, and drink that water and then you'll get pregnant.
Mm.
So she did. And then she had a baby and then they changed their name to Orosunsade, which then became shortened to Osunsade. But as I grew up, there was always like folklore and some kind of like mysticism in my life.
But how's it viewed? Is it viewed like... derogatorily, or is it people kind of, is it respected, or is it?
I think within Nigeria, it's just like an everyday thing.
It is.
Like hopping down to boots. You know, like the way Chinese people are really into traditional Chinese medicine.
Yeah, it's the same
thing in Nigeria. Like, if people are like, you know, praying to get a job or like going through an illness, they'll like go to church and then the next day they'll be at their like babalawo, which is like they're like, you know, witch doctor. I hate the word witch doctor because
it's a very Western.
You just
like,
think of someone like bones in their hair, like ooga booga. But you know what I mean? Like you would, it's just totally normal. It's totally common. Like you go to the market in Lagos and there'll be the person selling like fruit, person selling vegetables, and then there'll be the person selling like all the ingredients for spells. So he'll have like dried up snake skins and like a bit of this powder and a bit of that. And it's just like, oh yeah, cool. I'll just take 2 crow's feet and python skin. Yeah.
It's amazing how like it's actually quite denigrated though. Like I've noticed like even from people in the diaspora, they'll say things like, oh, you know, it's voodoo or it's like juju, whatever, like, and it's not seen positively. And I'm kind of like, and as I've grown up, I've realized, well, these are kind of traditional African belief systems, and we've kind of swallowed the Western perception that this is like black magic. This is, you shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I'm not religious in any stripe, but I just find it interesting. Like, and yeah, you're right. And it's one thing that I haven't seen touched upon, that in Black Panther, the Jabari tribe and the main tribes, they believe in their traditional deities. Like, there is no monotheism whatsoever, like, within thing. And I thought that was quite a good touch, actually. I liked it.
It was nice because it just, I felt that it was very true to African culture in that way. I mean, African people were colonized by Christians. Christianity is a new thing, if you think of the history in Africa, history of Africa as a whole. So even when people were like, okay, yeah, cool, I'm going to go to church, they were still like, but I'm not going to forsake the gods that brought me into this world or that we've depended on all this time.
Mm.
So yeah, so I loved that. And it was just so like magical every time they did it. And this idea of like, you know, is time linear?
Yeah.
Or is time circular? Because in Wakanda, time is not linear, right? You have a world where time is circular. So even though people have died, as it were, or like moved on to another plane, you can still contact them and interact with them. And I thought that was pretty cool.
So the key question here is, are you Team Killmonger or not? Because, you know, a lot of people have just been like, he wasn't the bad guy. Obviously, he was intended to be the bad guy.
Mm.
If you look at the script, some of the things that he did where he's choking out Auntie because she intended her to burn the flowers and everything. That was obviously where we had to be like, okay, make him the bad guy. Like, he's the bad guy stuff. But in terms of his overarching philosophy, do you consider him to be the villain?
That's such a good question. I definitely thought he was a great like protagonist and a good bad guy because his whole narrative around, you know, I came from the streets and like y'all didn't do nothing to help me, which I guess is true to some extent, but then I do still think he's the bad guy because he was oversimplifying the reality. Like, yes, Wakanda has resources, and yes, it's important for oppressed Black people in America to know in this fictional world that there are Black people out there who are not oppressed and who do great things and have freedom and stuff. But I felt that it was just such an oversimplification that, like, if African Americans knew about Wakanda, everything would be different. I was like, I don't know.
But he wasn't trying to, it wasn't about knowing about them. He actually wanted them to impact their lives, essentially.
But the way that he wanted to do it was...
Yeah, he was on this Malcolm X shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, let's overthrow this. Let's overthrow this motherfucker's like, yeah. But I don't know. I don't think he's that clear cut, really. Because...
What do you think?
I don't necessarily think I agree with overthrowing governments, essentially, through violent means. But what I did think that... And this is not surprising because this is at the end of the day a Marvel movie. It's just produced by a multi-billion-dollar corporation, essentially.
Yes.
But I didn't like the fact the way that at the end T'Challa is going in front of the United Nations and basically saying we're here to offer our technology. And I'm like, yo, you should be doing this at African Union. Can we build up Africa first, please? You know what I'm saying? You're surrounded by countries that are impoverished. Can we build those? Can we build ourselves up first, and then we can talk about? You see what I'm saying? Like building and helping others. That's how I personally see it. But obviously, yeah, within the confines of the script, he's meant to be the villain. But what's interesting, actually, is that Chadwick Boseman, the actor who plays Black Panther, has come out and said that he saw Black Panther, actually, as the bad guy. As an African-American, personally, he saw him as, essentially, the obstacle to progression for his particular group of people.
Yes.
And I just found the whole film so interesting in terms of... Because I didn't expect that it would touch upon the gap between African-Americans. Or not gap, I mean the distance between African-Americans and the diaspora in general and Africa.
Yeah.
And that there isn't a lot of... contact, and when there is contact, it's not necessarily positive.
There's a lot of friction. Yeah,
there's a lot of friction, and Killmonger represents the African American, even though he's half Wakandan.
Yes,
and he's like, "Where were you guys? Like, why haven't you helped us, or why don't you help us, or why isn't there any kind of outreach here, like between our two groups, essentially?" And I recommend everybody watch an interview with Ryan Coogler, the director. He was on Hot 97, and he directed Creed also, and he says that all the films that he makes, they're about him coming to grips with a certain part of his life. So Creed was about father-son relationships. And this was about, what does it mean to be an African when you are from diaspora, whether that's African-American, African-Caribbean, or even someone who's first generation like myself outside of the continent. And yeah, I just find it so fascinating, really.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think it is quite, like, the first emotion I feel is sadness.
Yeah.
That there is tension within, like, one racial group. Because the reality is we make ourselves the enemy. When if there is any enemy, it's the people from outside our race that continue to oppress us, right? I remember being, like, a young kid in America, going to public school in America and, you know, writing book reports, and my dad would come and see them, my dad being Nigerian, and maybe I would write like, oh, I'm African American. And my dad would get really angry and be like, no, you're not African American, you're an American African. And I was like, why are you so angry?
An American African? I thought you would say like Nigerian American.
No, and I was like, why are you so angry? And he's like, because... He's like, African-American people are the descendants of slaves. And we are not the descendants of slaves. We are the descendants of African royalty. And I was like, why are we getting so uppity? Like, why is it so important to make the distinction? And then at the same time, I would go to school and then I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm not African-American, I'm Nigerian. And then people would be like, oh, you're an African booty scratcher. And that was like the diss. That was like the diss at school for like Black kids who are not African-American. And yeah, like, so it's just this theme that I've always been very conscious of. And again, here in London, you know, there's a lot of tension between, you know, British Africans versus people from the West Indies and the Caribbean and
not
stuff.
As much. When I was growing up, it was not as much. When I was growing up, it was like, yeah, it wasn't cool to be African.
Keeping
it 100, like a lot of people from, you know, Caribbean would be like, you guys are, you know, just a few comments here and there. But it's changed now. I see a lot more unity and a lot more
Togetherness
now as I've grown older.
And with regard to progress, which is definitely what I want, what you want, what most of us want, I think it's good that the film had the balls to like tackle that
and
bring it to the forefront, because it's so important to have conversations like this, because a lot of like the prejudices that we have are just like inherited from what we heard at home or like whatever, and it's so important to like actually like put those under the, you know, microscope and think, why do I think that, where did that idea come from, is that idea justified?
Yeah, I think, yeah, just last notes on the film. It's just amazing that essentially a Pan-African film was financed by Disney. Like, I couldn't believe it. If you told me this a few years ago, I wouldn't believe it. Because essentially, to me, it is a Pan-African film because it has to unite all people of the African diaspora and the continent. So, like, hats off. And I'm glad that it's making all the money. It's going to hit a billion, apparently. It hasn't even opened in China yet. So, yeah, shout out to Marvel. Shout out to everybody involved.
Shout out to Marvel. We'll say one thing.
Go ahead.
It was funny watching American people like imitating African accents. Like they kind of opted for like the like South African like
South accent. Africa.
Yeah. Why couldn't they also just find some legit African actors? What's up with that?
You're gonna open a whole other can of worms.
I'm just saying.
Because
you
Danny Kaluuya, who was in Get Out,
yes,
there was backlash because he was playing an African American and he's a British Ugandan, and people were like, why can't you've got an American actor to play, you know, an American role? So if we open that can of worms, it's like, you know how many British actors are in the States doing American accents, getting money, like, and
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So like, we can't really talk shit, to be honest, over here, because with
but the film was set in Africa, in a fictional kingdom in Africa. You have Nollywood, like there's a booming film industry across the continent,
but it's still an American movie,
and it's still financed by
Americans.
But Lupita was in there doing her Kenyan thing. Where are the others? That's all I'm saying.
I mean, to me, it doesn't bother me. I'm of the opinion, if we're talking about, you know, unity across, you know, all African diasporas, it shouldn't bother us that, you know, that we have African-Americans or second-generation Africans like Lupita playing people from Wakanda. It doesn't bother me, per se.
Interesting.
Bothers you a little bit, though, I can tell. You've got some Nigerians up in there.
I felt that they could have tried harder to actually bring in more, like, more people from the continent, whether they're actors, whether they're, you know, musicians on the soundtrack. There were some South African artists on the soundtrack that I recognized some stuff, which was cool. But I think they could have done a bit more. But like you said, you know, it's a Disney movie. It's an American movie. I'll be grateful for what I've got. But like, next time, Black Panther 2, they should film it like on location.
They didn't even film in Africa. Keeping it 100.
Yeah, I was thinking. It's all green screen, right? Yeah, you can tell. Great effects, though. I was just like,
some of it wasn't that great.
No, like
when he's,
the rhinos.
No, that's not that big. You know, when like on Challenge Day, when he's about to become king and he's got to fight Mbaku, like people on the mountaintops kind of dancing. It's a bit like, guys, come on, don't rush it. I know you want to make all this pee, but can we just slow down a little bit and like get this film like properly through post-production?
The other thing I have to say, they made such a big deal about his like noiseless sneakers.
Sneakers, yeah, that was fine. That was a good line.
No, but then later on, when they're like, oh, like so-and-so's here, and he runs up the ramp, his feet make noise.
Okay. Let's not bait out all the plot holes, man.
I'm just saying.
Meant to be an uplifting discussion about Black Panther, and now we're just nitpicking here.
We have to be critical. Fair is fair.
Of the opinion you've got to be critical in private. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
But in public, we uplift.
Okay.
You see what
I'm saying? Fine.
That's what I always say to my friends.
I'll criticize you
in public, in private, but in public, I'll be like, yeah, my friend, perfect.
Wakanda forever,
yeah. All right, let's hop on to winners and losers, what people came for. Okay. Who you got first? Who's a winner?
Spotify,
baby.
I love Spotify. When people are like, oh, Apple Music, Tidal, I was like, nah.
You're sticking to Spotify?
I'm sticking to Spotify.
So what's so good about Spotify? Let the people know.
Okay, number one, Discover Weekly.
No, but why are they in the news? We haven't even said why they're in the
news. Right, they're in the news. Oh, Spotify are going public.
They're going public. Woo! They want to make that shmoney.
Make the shmoney. It's interesting, though, because they're doing a direct listing.
Yeah.
So like normally when a tech company wants to go public, let's say Techish Podcast, you know, global domination.
One day.
We're ready to cash out.
One day.
The founders, they go on a roadshow. So you like present to, you know, whatever, banks, other institutional investors and kind of say, you know, this is what our company does. This is our growth trajectory. This is how much we're going to ask for in shares. This is the valuation of our company. Spotify have set their valuation at $1 billion, I think.
No. So I think it's $23
billion.
$1 billion is like, that's chump change in the tech world.
Chump change.
Like,
that's like, Techish Pod.
Techish Podcast will be $1 billion in a couple of weeks. Don't watch that. So in a normal IPO, it's done in tandem with banks, basically.
Yes.
So you work with a bank and they just go to their institutional investors and they help you come up with a valuation. And they issue new shares. This is all information that I learned like on the way here because I didn't know the details about this. So I've learned something new.
Nice.
And in this instance, they're bypassing the banks. Mm-hmm. They're going to directly list themselves. They're not issuing any new shares. So the existing shareholders, so the founders, existing investors, they're going to sell their existing shares and not issue new shares.
Yeah.
So it's not about raising money. Essentially, it's a cash out for the people that have worked in the business for God knows how long. I remember Spotify when I was a kid, like really, really young. Yeah. It was like 10 plus years. And yeah, so what do you think? What do you think of their prospects?
I don't know. It's kind of interesting because I guess you have to kind of ask about the motivation. So why do people want to cash out now? There's been a lot of like not necessarily positive feedback around Spotify as Apple Music and Tidal have gained market share.
You think?
And also, you know, artists like Taylor Swift take their whole That's collection true. Off. People saying that Spotify royalties don't pay as much.
Yeah.
You know, the pessimist might be like, oh, is this the beginning of the end? Because obviously you put a lot of money into a company, but you're locked out from actually liquidating
It's paper those wealth. Assets. It's not real wealth, essentially. If your company is valued at $1 billion and you can't sell your shares, it's not real wealth at that point. Exactly. It's literally just paper wealth. So this is the point where it becomes real moolah, essentially.
Mm.
And we missed out the key point that Spotify hasn't made a dime in any profits so far. In fact, I think I was reading how the year before they lost $500 million.
Wow.
This year, they lost $1.5 billion. Because when you're not profitable, the faster you grow, the more money you lose. It's like having a hole in a ship.
Yeah.
So I'm saying like, and the hole's just getting bigger, essentially, because they're growing so big. Mm. And most of their losses stem from the fact they have to pay enormous royalties to the record labels.
Yeah.
So is it sustainable in the long run? Like, I don't know how they're gonna make it work.
I mean, it's kind of interesting, right? Because if you think of Spotify, it is 10 years old, if not more. And like... Mm. What has it really innovated in recently?
I think the Discover Weekly playlist. That shit knows me better than my mum. I'm like, how the fuck do they know this? Like, they're finding some bangers. Like, I'm like, I can't believe this. Yeah. Like, so that, and that's completely AI driven, like machine learning.
But then YouTube also has a really good algorithm. I know people that make their music playlists on YouTube, and it's free. If you have an ad blocker, you can pretty much like cut through all of that. So I mean, it's a good question. Like from like an investor's perspective, like, yeah, like, are you going to go long on Spotify?
I would go long if they do what Netflix did, which is essentially go into original content. So I think Spotify should be setting up their own label, essentially signing artists and distributing them exclusively through Spotify. If they just went through SoundCloud.
Like Tidal style.
What Tidal and Apple have done is they've taken existing artists and got them with exclusive deals to distribute through Tidal and Apple. But I'm talking about Spotify needs to be going from the ground up, finding young
like
talent.
Upcoming talent,
exactly.
Right.
Nurturing them, getting them big, put them on the playlists, which have millions of like listens. In fact, these playlists are now becoming make or break. Like, I have a friend of mine in the music industry, and getting on these playlists is like getting on radio back in the day. It's really like a big fucking
deal.
Like
Rap Caviar and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. You can really make or break you. So they should be signing and nurturing these young artists and then using their platform and tie them in. Then I would be like, okay, this is a model where I see some, it's defensible, like it's really a clever idea. But at the moment, beyond like the defensibility of the playlists, I don't see much like...
See, my problem with that is that like the music industry is actually a very low margin business. It's kind of similar to venture capital if you think about it. There's definitely some similarities because you take all of these super early stage, unproven startups, but who have like an interesting sound, vision or brand, whatever, throw a shit ton of money into them.
Yeah.
Send them on tour, team them up with the best PR and branding and whatever. And then, like, it's just a race to get, like you said, onto that playlist or onto number one or into that show
or
into that film.
One or two might become Lady Gaga and pay for the rest of it, though.
You're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
And then the rest will be never heard of again.
Yeah, I mean, it's fuckery if you're the actual young talent that gets left by the wayside.
Mm.
But in terms of the returns, if you manage to pick out a Lady Gaga, it pays for everything else, essentially. Just like you might invest in 100 startups and one ends up being Facebook.
Yeah.
And that pays for
the
entire batch, essentially. But yeah, I'm in between with Spotify. They're definitely a winner right now, obviously, for going public.
Of course.
Congrats to them and the whole team. But in terms of their long-term prospects, especially, you know, Apple's there, Tidal's there.
Mm.
And they've all got similar models. It'd be interesting to see how it plays out.
I would just like to see them maybe like experimenting more with like the user experience. Like I still find that the web app takes like, or rather like the laptop on my laptop, it takes a really long desktop app takes so long to load.
Is it?
Yeah. The mobile app is fine, and Discover Weekly is something I look forward to all the time. And in general, I also just really like, you know, making radio out of one track.
I mean,
they've got very good AI at work there. But yeah, it would just be nice to see them like just dropping something new, keeping us excited.
Anything else on Spotify?
Not for me.
Okay. Let's move on to our next winner and loser. Who's up?
You were talking about the Light Phone.
Light Phone.
Tell me about the Light Phone.
So Light Phone is a phone that is a Light Phone. Light Phone is a phone that's it's a very basic pared down phone. It was invented by these two dudes who wanted to build an app in an incubator, and they realized that, you know, I don't actually want to, you know, suffocate people with more apps. What people need is a detox from their phone.
Mm.
So they came up with a simple phone called Light Phone that pairs with your existing phone.
Yeah.
And all it can do is take calls and texts, essentially. So it's a way of essentially detoxifying yourself from newsfeed, social media apps, all the emails essentially, and I don't know. I think I might get one.
Is it a winner or loser? Because Lifeone's been around for a while. Lifeone came out like over.
They've got a new
version
coming out. Basically, they got Lifeone 2, and they're raising funds on Indiegogo.
Amazing.
The only thing that, or Kickstarter, one of the two. The only thing that made me laugh is the fact that they're adding more features to it, which kind of it's like Lifeone
now,
in 2025, exactly
in 4G.
Like the iPhone. I think because now they you can do there's like a navigation app on there. And I don't know, it kind of defeats the purpose. If you're going to add more features, I think what happened is they released the Lifeone and people were like, I would like to use it, but I need X.
I need a bit more. Yeah. It's because people just, they can't unplug from the matrix. It's too deep. I stopped bringing my phone into my bedroom.
Swear on.
Yeah. I don't bring my phone into my room anymore because my room is where I sleep, where I read, where I like meditate, but not where I'm distracted.
I was going to ask the dumbest question. It shows you how plugged in I am. I was like, what do you use for an alarm?
Good question. I have a Lumi. No brand sponsorship, but
please
send me a free one if you want.
Yeah, please.
But it's basically like a light. So every time I go to sleep, I set it for like 7.5 hours from when I'm asleep. And what will happen is 15 minutes before that time. So let's say I wake up at 6:30. From 6:15, the light will slowly get brighter, like a dimmer switch.
It replicates the sun essentially, basically.
Yeah, so that's how I wake up.
That's
so
awesome.
I just wake up by light.
Awesome.
The Lifeone, I think, you know, I first think I saw it like maybe on Product Hunt and then on like Arianna Huffington's Thrive Global, because they have a shop all around Wellbeing. And it was something where I immediately was like, oh, that's a really good idea. But then when I thought about it, I was like, or I could just leave my phone at home.
Yeah, but you need to be contacted a little bit though.
But
come
on. But the thing is, right, I'll give you an example, right? So I started doing Sundays as a no phone day. Because
I've tried to text you on Sundays, airtime. But anyways,
because either I'm at home being lazy, doing my own thing, or I would have already made my plans for the Sunday before Sunday. So like I'm catching up with a friend for lunch or meeting other friends at
the
pub.
You'd be like, meet me here at 12. If you're late, that's it. Basically, you can't contact them.
Yeah, but we won't be. We got to go old school, like 90s style. Like say it on Messenger, say it on email, and then just be there on time, and then don't be late. I don't know. Like, I think that we're so locked into like capitalism and consumption that like every solution to a problem has to be through buying something else. Like, oh, I want to use my phone less, so I'm going to buy a phone that has fewer features. Turn your damn phone off. Like, be disciplined.
I don't think it's that simple.
It should be, though. The reason it's not that simple is because of the psychology of addiction that the product designers have created.
Yeah, and also I'm so used to being in the matrix in a sense that I'm used to being constantly contactable that I feel like, oh my God, I'm missing out. Like, you know, FOMO, they call it, fear of missing out.
But what are you missing out on?
Nothing.
Like a frigging Twitter notification or like Instagram tag. Or
even
whatever.
Just a phone call or a text. You know, there might be an event happening. And I know it's complete bullshit. It's complete bullshit. My social life isn't that popping anyway. So,
yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah,
like, anybody
and to be honest,
you.
What you're missing out on is the present moment.
Yeah.
Like I've been with my friends and we're out and everybody's on their phone. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, pardon my French. I'm like, what the hell is this like?
Yeah.
And we've had to do a thing where we're like, you put your phone on the table. First person to reach for their phone. It's got to pay.
Drinks. I love
basically.
That. That's
like,
good.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. It's ridiculous the hold that these companies have over our psychology. Like, it's like a slot machine. Like, literally, I find myself scrolling through my timeline and I'm not even conscious of what I'm doing. Like I'm just kind of just going through the motions.
Yeah.
And that whole fun thing of just scrolling, it's just like a reflex now. And I'm like, yo.
That's why I delete Instagram all the time. Because like Instagram,
but everyone deletes it. It's not a permanent thing.
Well, no,
it's
because, you know, I gotta see what's going on.
They got you. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's like, all of us are it's only a matter of degree. Some of us are completely entrapped by it. And some of us are not so much. And some of us have a healthy relationship. I'm not going to say we're on the spectrum. I fall.
I think we all know that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Read between the lines.
Yeah.
Addict. So maybe you should get a light phone, actually.
I might have to.
I think you...
I'm acknowledging that. I don't have the strength to leave my phone at home. I just don't have it. Like, I'm going to be concerned about missing out on stuff. So at least I know that if someone can text or call me, even if there's an emergency, I'm there. But social media, you know, whatever, like, it's
so,
just not that.
Can I ask you, the last thing you look at before you go to sleep?
Social media, facts.
First thing you look at when you wake
social
up?
Social media, facts. Twitter timeline. My girlfriend's like, you're addicted to
Twitter. Can I dare you to not do that?
You just can dare me,
like...
but I don't mean I'm more going to do it. You see what I'm saying? Like, we'd have to put some money on the line. We'd have to be like, listen, otherwise I'm not going to do it. Like, I guess there are things like what you've done. Put your phone in a different room.
Yeah.
For example.
And once I get home from the day, boom, leave it. And then I don't touch it again in the morning.
You know, I wasn't that bad until basically I started making, like running businesses that use social media a lot. Like once I started Pocket and stuff, like, and even this podcast, for example, it's probably made it even worse because I'm always thinking, oh my God, is someone shouting us out? Is anybody using the hashtag? Like, so Yeah, it's difficult.
You know what that is though, right?
Addiction.
Well, yeah, no, but you know, like on, like sometimes I think it's nice to like talk about the science behind that behavior.
Dopamine hit. Is that what you're going to say? Yeah, it is.
Exactly.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, your body is becoming addicted to that little high that you get every time you see that red dot. There was a really good article in the New York Times all around like, whatever, the addiction to red dots and how, you know, more people are turning their phone into grayscale
so that
they don't see, like, you know, the little red dot bat on the badges on their phone, like, ooh, who WhatsApped me, who whatever, you just become addicted to these little highs, these little thrills on a subconscious level before you're even conscious of it. But I think once you know that, then it's within your power to mitigate that.
I don't know if we talked about this. I might have mentioned it on my friend's podcast, Off the Cuff, shout out to them. That Instagram was rumbled for holding back on your likes, essentially. So when I post a picture on Instagram, they won't show me the exact amount of likes that I've got straight away.
What? Yeah. That's so shady.
So that you will come back and check again.
Staggering them.
Yeah. So, oh my gosh. You know, if you're the kind of person that's putting up a selfie
and
it's like you've got 10 likes, but normally you might get 50 to 100 likes. You're thinking, what's going on? You check back again later. That constant scroll down thing of refresh, refresh, refresh. Like, it's ridiculous. They've got some of, I said this on that podcast too, they've got some of the smartest people in the world working out how to keep you addicted and scrolling for a timeline and showing you advertisements, essentially. And that's what the finest minds of our generation are working on.
Working on advertising. Yeah. Hey, man.
So, but yeah, back to the light phone. I might do it. I think it's about $200 bucks, though. So it's quite expensive. I might as well just get a burner phone, just get an old school Nokia. But the only thing about that is you can't pair it with your number. That's the only thing.
My friend actually had a 3310 like a couple of years ago. He just went back to the 3310 for a while. He was like, I'm doing it. He got it on eBay, like literally 15 quid.
Visionary.
Put a SIM card in it and was just like rocking that.
Yeah. I think
he got lost a lot because he didn't have maps. But other than that, he was fine.
The algorithms are ruling everything.
I think it kind of also shows how, like, millennials are aging. Because, you know, Nokia have come back and released the banana phone, the phone in the Matrix.
Flip phone. Yeah.
I don't know what number that one is. But they're like, oh, we re-released this phone because, you know, people get nostalgic about the handset and the whatever. Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, there's something within, like, the human race where, like, we'll always get to a point where it's like, enough change. Nostalgia. Enough change. I want things to be like how they were in the good old days.
Yeah.
And I was reading in The Guardian, like, about these, like neo-Luddites. And obviously, like, Luddites were the people in the 1800s in the UK who would destroy, like, agricultural machinery and, like, factory machinery because
it wasn't
they were
that
worried.
they were weave makers, essentially, and there was machinery that came in that automated their job. So they were quite rational. It wasn't as if they just thought, fuck it, let's just destroy technology. It was kind of like, this technology is kind of, obviously I don't sanction this, but this technology is taking away our job, essentially.
Yeah, but then that's a limiting mindset because you assume that's the only job you can do.
Yeah, but in
technology
the 18th
century, also creates jobs.
In the 18th century?
In the 18th century?
No, come on.
No, seriously.
You can't be like, guys, like, you know.
New industries.
Yeah, but you don't think of it in that sense. And also capitalism, in a sense that we understand, was quite new then. They weren't thinking like, oh, you know, creative destruction, there's going to be new industries. Yeah. They were thinking, this is how my family have earned bread for X amount of years, and now it's gone. But anyway, yeah, that's a tangent.
But yeah, so this
shout
idea...
Shout out to the Luddites. Wherever they are now. Rest in peace.
But this idea of, like, being averse to technological advances is, you know, digital detox is an example of that, right? Like, every time the word digital detox is said, a part of Mark Zuckerberg dies, right? that's the truth.
Yeah, for real.
So it's like, there is definitely this, like, kind of movement where it's like, oh, okay, like, now we're kind of a bit more clued up on technology and how we're, like, subconsciously and psychologically dependent on it. I think it's good that these conversations are happening. I think it's good that people are making things like the light phone. I'm interested to see how far people take it and where people go with it.
Yeah, I don't think the light phone is the answer, but it's a start of a conversation.
Yeah. There are already apps that, like, reward you for not looking at your phone.
Is it?
Yeah. And there's like one, I forget the name now. I think it started in Denmark maybe, but it's for students who want to revise but keep getting distracted by their phone.
Oh.
So the longer you don't unlock your phone, the more points you gain. And then those points convert into, like, discounts at, like, shops.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Like, you can then use it at the cafe, at the bar, at, like, whatever,
what's the
fashion
incentive?
Store.
What's the incentive for the businesses to do that, though? I don't get it.
So it's basically, like, a marketing channel for those companies who probably would already put that into their student discount or any other marketing budget. So the app just, like, creates partnerships with these people, and then it's advertising and branding.
That's quite ingenious.
Because then when you do look at your phone, you're seeing, boom, now spend it here, spend it there.
That's a great idea.
Okay, so winners. We've had two winners. We need to move on to losers. We need some balance. Okay, we need some yin and yang.
Okay, so we've got a super loser. I want to talk about this dude with this damn Fyre Festival.
Please, yeah.
So Fyre, it was a Fyre app, I think, at first, where you could book talent, essentially. It was a way of kind of letting anybody be a promoter.
Nice.
So for example, I don't know, you might have Charlamagne the God on there. If I wanted him to do an appearance at my nightclub, I could just use the app and book him and pay him through the app.
Which That's is cool.
a pretty smart idea, right?
I love that.
But the guy behind it wanted to use his own app to do a festival called the Fyre Festival.
Yeah.
It was meant to be the super luxury, super premium festival in the like some isolated Caribbean island, I think
I
it
remember.
Was.
Ja Rule was going to be
ja
there.
Ja Rule was going to be there. What's Ja Rule got to say about this anyway? It's a Chappelle joke. But yeah, so it went to shit, essentially. The festival turned out to be a complete palaver. Like, there was nobody was, like, there was no toilets, there was no clean water, there was no nothing. Like, it wasn't, there was no food.
How much was the most expensive ticket? Like, $1,000?
It was something ridiculous. I think it might be more than that. I think right. it was extortionate.
Yeah, and then someone tweeted a picture of a meal and it was a paper plate with a piece of white sliced bread
yep.
and like coleslaw yep. and they're like, look at my meal.
I remember seeing all the tweets like, help, we're trapped, like there's no wow. food, there's no, like we can't do anything, whatever, whatever. And obviously at the time, like, you know, eat the rich in it. I didn't feel that sympathetic for people that spent $2,000 on a ticket. So essentially, anyways, this guy got sued and now he's had criminal charges against him.
Wow.
Not just for fucking up a festival. He got in trouble because it turned out that he defrauded his investors. So he raised millions of pounds. And it turned out to be a whole bunch of bullshit. He exaggerated, you know, how successful the app was.
Yeah.
He exaggerated how much money he had.
Oof.
And he's facing 10 plus years in jail.
Shit,
so
man.
He fucked.
That's so horrible.
Do you feel sorry for the investors or is it kind of just like... I mean,
I don't have enough information because a part of me is like, do you know what? There are so many cheats and crooks in capitalism. Sir Philip Green sold BHS to someone else for £1 and then like liquidated the whole company and made hundreds of people unemployed. Like, how is that not criminality?
There goes our Topshop sponsorship.
I'm
joking.
But you know what I mean? It's like, okay, well, he's still walking the streets and like sailing his yacht through the Mediterranean.
Yeah,
and like, it's such a broad spectrum and there's such a big gray area. Like, everyone is kind of a crook in some extent.
No, definitely. But I think what frustrates me about that story is how so many people struggle to raise capital. And
yes.
particularly like, you know, black women, just general black people, people of color, like it's so difficult to access those networks and raise the kind of money that this dude raised. And he turned out, he was talking complete shit, essentially. Yeah. And I don't know what it says about the ecosystem where people can just do that and get away with it, essentially. Well, he hasn't got away with it. He's going to go to jail, hopefully, for a long time. But it's like...
What's his background? Do you know?
In terms of what?
Like, what did he do before?
I don't think he'd done anything.
Where is he from?
I don't think... He definitely wasn't one of those guys that had an exit beforehand and was, you know, had a proven track record. He was just a tech bro that came through and was like, I've got this app, can I raise millions of dollars? And by any means necessary, he did it and he lied and now he's got busted.
The thing is, right, and again with that, it kind of reminds me of that Juicero story. You remember Juicero? Okay, so like Juicero was this company that was like, oh, we've invented like the first smart juicing system, AI powered juicing system.
It was
system.
Basically Nutribullet, wasn't it?
It was Nutribullet.
It was fucking Nutribullet.
And
they
it
raised...
was like, yeah, they raised
I don't know the number, but
multi-millions, I'm sure. It was definitely over, like, it was an insane amount for like a pre-launch product.
Maybe there should be like a section we do where we like talk about our favorite, you know, people that have raised money, but it's like really stupid.
We should
like,
do
yeah,
that.
Like, well, we're kind of laughing because my other one was the mayonnaise company.
What was that?
they were a tech company, I'm doing air quotes here, that made mayonnaise. It was some special proprietary
smart
mayonnaise.
Smart mayo.
It wasn't smart
AI
mayo.
Powered
like,
mayo.
I think it was mayonnaise that their formula was proprietary and it wasn't animal-based. Something like that.
Okay.
So in their defense, it was some kind of innovation
like
going on, right?
Like Impossible Burger kind of
but
style.
Kind of, yeah. But they raised so much money. And then it turned out that they were buying their own stock.
Hellman's.
From stores.
Hellman's mayonnaise.
As in, like, they would get their product stocked in, like, Whole Foods, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And to juice up sales, they would use their own capital to
buy... Oh, no. Oh my God, that's so bad.
But this is what happens though sometimes.
What
world
do we live in?
Like, if you give millions of dollars to, like, you know, people in their 20s, there's going to be a certain percentage of people that are just going to be like, we've got to do whatever it takes to make this work. Fuck it. Let's just like, fuck it. Let's just buy our own thing, our own shit back and make it look as if like we're really successful and juice up these numbers.
I think that also says a lot about the vanity metrics that we speak about within tech. Like, you know, what are the real things we're measuring success by? And a lot of these metrics, like, that just goes to show our vanity metrics are completely superficial. They don't really show
but
anything.
You have to have essentially when you raise capital, there's an emphasis on metrics.
Mm.
So instead of the emphasis being do people love our product? Mm-hmm. How does it taste?
Yeah.
Are people like coming back and repeat purchasing? It's more like, what are the numbers? What,
hockey
does, it
stick
like, what does it look like on the Excel spreadsheet?
Of course.
That we can send to our investors and raise more money, essentially. Like,
you just want that line to be constantly growing, shooting up.
And the one concept that's always irked me, and I've used it, I said it myself, is hack, basically. Growth hack, where essentially you're looking for shortcuts, essentially to make sure that your company can go from A to B as quickly as possible. And that's an example where I can imagine in a team meeting, they could be like, okay, guys, I've got this hack. What we'll do is we'll buy our product back. Yeah.
That's like, so sad.
And I've seen it, like, even in, I remember at university, one dude, we had a lot of group work when I was at university.
Yeah.
And one dude who I didn't want to be in the group with would get people to do his work for him just by not turning up. And I said to him, what the fuck are you doing? That's so rude. He's like, yeah, it's a hack. I was like,
oh my God.
I was like, this is how far this whole like Tim Ferriss like life hack culture has got, where people think screwing somebody over is a hack. It's not a hack. You're just a bad person.
You're just
like,
lazy.
What the fuck? Like, anyways, that's a whole nother side tangent. But it's
true though. There's always givers and takers. Yeah. And usually you're one of them.
Now they can kind of shroud themselves in like, oh, it's a hack.
It's a hack, yeah. Cheater, or it's hustle.
Yeah.
Oh, cheating people out of their money because they're too stupid to understand is a hustle.
Yeah.
The thing that frustrates me about this as well is where is the due diligence on the investor's part?
Mm.
You know, with fake mayo and smart juicing Nutribullet and even with Fyre Festival.
Mm.
One of the biggest reasons, you know, women, LGBTQ, people of color, founders don't get access to capital is because they don't get past that first hurdle. You know, the investors look at the pitch decks and go, not for me.
Yeah.
Not a big enough business.
Don't understand it.
Not going to make enough money. I'm not interested. And then you had a company like Juicero. So Juicero, for those of you guys who don't know, was saying it was going to be like, you know, changing the health game. Everyone was going to have one in their home. You had to subscribe to receive their latest recipes, kale, cucumber, whatever juice.
Yeah.
You had to put it into this special piece of hardware, which costs like $600 or something, for it to then, you know, juice it up in the perfect blend that was
It's Nutribullet.
Literally, as soon as a journalist got their hands on it, he squeezed it without the machine and it went into his glass. And he's like, why do I need the machine if I can just squeeze it out the packet?
Mm.
And then the company fell apart. The company just fell apart because then everyone was like, you don't need the machine. You can just squeeze the bag. Oh my God. And I was just like, so you're telling me that it's gone through how many pitches, met how many investors, how many term sheets were exchanged. No one squeezed that bag of juice.
I'm going to play devil's advocate. So I would say, you know what, in the defense of, you know, the VC community, the angel investor community, how many companies get funded? Every year, it's probably thousands.
Mm.
And how many stories do we have where it turns out to be like out and out fraud, complete bollocks? Like, there's a lot of failures, don't get twisted, but it's like failures that, okay, you tried. It was something, okay, whatever. Another photo sharing app, you tried, kind of thing. But in terms of just out and out fraud, it's a handful.
Mm.
The largest one that I know, have you heard of Theranos?
Yeah.
The whole blood.
Like, Elizabeth Holmes.
Yeah, so it was a company where they said that we'll take a sample of your blood and we'd give you back some amazing, you know, analysis about your health and blah, 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 blah. And they had all these partnerships with, you know, Walgreens.
Yeah.
And it was meant to be some amazing futuristic shit, basically. And it turned out to be, well, the company's still going now.
Yeah.
But it's turned out that nobody knows if they're actually onto anything, if it isn't just a complete mirage.
Yeah.
And the company was valued like billions of dollars. Actually, they raised money after money after money. And they had like, on their board member, I think they had like Henry Kissinger or someone along, like really like top level like people like and people like, what's going on here? There's no product.
How is it more than just like the standard
there's no
blood
product.
Test that
there's no product
exists.
Like there was literally no product. And you know, it's funny, I was meant to be playing devil's advocate.
I was gonna say, where like, are you going with this?
I was meant to be playing devil's advocate, but like I can't pretend and say that there isn't some fuckery that happens from time to time. There is. Anyways, we'll come back to this another time, I'm sure, because I think we might have to do that section when we just find a company that got funded where we're like,
but that never made it.
Or I will tell you the company and you have to tell me if it's real or fake.
Oh, okay.
If I've made it up.
Do that now.
But I haven't got an example. But future episode, and you'll be like, is this a real startup or is this a fake startup? Anyways, we'll come back to it.
Okay,
who's
cool.
up? Who's up next for us? Have we got another loser?
We've got so many. this is tech after all. It's a lottery.
Who did we put down?
So there's rumors about Snapchat laying off people.
Yikes.
Ugh, the IPO burden.
Like, I feel like we've talked about them in every episode so far.
We have, giving them too much money.
Yeah, probably. I think they're just, so they're doing layoffs and
they just grew too fast, hired too quickly, and now they're not making enough money. It's a classic thing. Once you're a public company, if you're if your profits aren't growing quarter on quarter, or you don't have a good enough reason for why they aren't, like Amazon famously is not a profitable company because it reinvests the funds into growth, then the investors are going to be like, well, we need to see something change.
But Amazon, it's a choice, right? They but Snapchat is not a choice.
That's not a choice.
They're not just making a dime.
I mean, they're just making losses. Like Spectacles were a massive loss.
Yikes.
I think it was like a nine-figure write-off or something.
Oh my God.
Eight or nine-figure write-off. And I guess, you know, they're just under the public eye now. So it's just like, right, okay, we're not making enough money. What's a quick way to make money? Fire people. Save on costs.
We've got too many engineers, essentially.
Probably.
That's ridiculous. Obviously, yeah. I feel sorry for the people that lost their jobs. That's never a nice thing.
But hopefully onto greener pastures.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they probably got recruiters in their DMs already, but it's Mark Zuckerberg is somewhere cackling, I guess. He's kind of... Yeah, man, he's giving them a Judas suit
really
to the leg,
like,
he took
evil,
him out.
Evil genius of...
I mean, let's not pretend that it wasn't on the cards even when he was a kid, like what he did to the Winklevoss brothers, you know, like...
Yeah.
Like... the film kind of portrays it as kind of like, I mean, who's the bad guy, who's the bad guy, we don't really know, but...
What about
if I put myself,
as well?
If I put myself in their shoes, I'm paying a kid to build my app.
Yeah.
And this kid is copying my app and building his own app.
Yeah.
And he's purposefully slowing down the development of my app.
Yeah.
So that his app can launch first.
Yeah. It's shady.
Yo.
Yeah.
He's lucky he didn't do it to the mafia. Like, they would have broke his leg for that. That's
but there's
crazy.
No ethics in capitalism, right? It's all about winners.
Yeah, I know. But
winners get to write the history books.
Yeah, for real. I think the Winklevoss twins, actually, now they've made billions.
They're
of Bitcoin
billionaires, yeah.
I don't know, but since the dip in Bitcoin price, but they've definitely
no, but
done
they
well
got
themselves.
In like early doors, wow. And were just like, yeah, doing their thing.
So imagine they ended up making more money than Mark Zuckerberg.
That would be hilarious.
That'd be interesting. That'd be interesting.
Well, so, there is a Bitcoin billionaire, but no one knows who it is. Like Satoshi.
I don't even. Who is he? No one knows
no
to this
one
day.
Knows.
So if you don't know, Satoshi is the originator and founder. Well, I don't know if founder is the right word because it's not a company.
Mm-mm.
He's the creator of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And nobody knows if the name is a real name, if it represents anybody, if it represents a group of people. And, you know, like, nobody knows, like, who this person is. And he's created this technology that for the last 10 years, it's been on the tip of everybody's tongue.
Mm. And has gained in value, like, an insane amount. Even though it's, like, low now, it's still insanely high compared to 10 years ago.
You know how everybody's like, yeah, I got in early, but how early is it if you get in at zero? Which is what he got in at.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
He got in at day one. It's his, like...
I mind the first coin.
Yeah, so if he held up until now, Lord have mercy, the wealth that this person has created. There are some interesting rumors that I heard one person say that they think it was the CIA that created it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. It just sounds like a wild conspiracy theory. But, I mean, essentially, it's unknown. It could be a group or an individual or...
Did you watch that documentary? This is like a tangent, but you know this idea of like, oh, who invented it? You remember the WannaCry virus?
No, what's that?
The WannaCry virus was the computer virus that took down all the NHS computers.
Ah, oh, yeah. And one random dude, like, stopped it, right? There was one random dude in one village, like, he stopped it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a documentary that alleges that was created by the CIA.
To the NHS? I guess the NHS.
No.
It wasn't intended to be to the NHS.
It wasn't intended to be.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, I'm so frustrated. I can't remember the name of the documentary. I'll put it in the comments for anyone
Oh, and the
listening.
NHS is the National Health Service of the UK, if you're listening in the States.
So the US wanted to stop Iran's nuclear...
I heard of that.
Nuclear agenda.
Yeah.
So... Oh, it was like super complicated to do because they can't penetrate Iran. Like, they have no diplomatic relations with them or whatever. So obviously the CIA have some of the best hackers in the world, some of the most intelligent minds in the world. So they came up with this idea to create a virus which could then be taken into the plants because they had enough intelligence to know that all of the plants were connected through some common network. And they're like, we could make a virus that someone can smuggle in on a USB plug-in or like whatever. I don't know how they're going to get it there. And it will basically just destroy all of the servers so that they would basically have to like destroy years of work.
I actually heard that it wasn't even just destroying it on a technological level. What it would do is that it would spin the centrifuges so fast
exactly.
that it would create an actual physical explosion.
Yes.
So it was a computer virus that would actually create a physical manifestation of an explosion, essentially.
Yeah.
So this documentary alleges that that or unrelated viruses that that also created by the CIA is what spread and hit the NHS up.
Because there are some people in America that basically, like, they're also hackers, and they, like, looked at the code, they looked at the origin of the code, and they spent ages trying to find out where it originated from, like, tracing IPs and all this kind of stuff.
Wasn't it a ransom, though?
And then they found it was a
ransom situation, wasn't it, though? As in, it was like a, give us bitcoins or else.
But this is the thing, the technology then got into the wrong hands.
Oh, I see.
Because now you've got the dark web and all these other people, like, hacking around.
Somebody
the world.
Got the source code and was like, guys, let's make some money, maybe.
Yes.
Some rogue agents, or maybe someone.
And then people tried to frame it on them as the inventors of WannaCry, but they didn't invent it.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
It's mad, isn't it?
Mm.
The code wars, they call it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
So anyway, I guess the winners are the hackers in that scenario.
Yeah. I wish I did. Like, I'm a developer, but I wish I did spend more time, like, learning about this stuff, like, and information security. Yeah,
it's not too late. Cybersecurity, like, that's going to be one of the biggest industries in tech. If people are like, oh, I don't know what to do, I don't know if I want to work in tech. And you don't just have to be a coder to be in cybersecurity.
I've got a friend of mine, like, he was working in the charity sector, and all of a sudden he just got a job in cybersecurity, just in sales, and he's just making money hand over fist because the demand is, like, so ridiculous that, like, you know, they're selling millions of dollars of contracts to big companies, and he's getting 10-20% commission. So it's like the opportunities are out there.
Think about how data is like the lifeblood of every tech company right now. Like,
the new
every
oil
product,
they call it, right?
The new oil. Every product you use for free, you are the product there, right? Yeah. So like CityMapper, they're selling all the data about your trips, Google Maps, Uber.
Facebook, everything.
Everything. Everything is just observing you, collecting that data, selling it to brands so that they can sell more stuff to you. And as that trend just grows and grows and grows, it becomes even more important for companies to then protect the data they have, because then you have a data breach, like Yahoo had the data breach a couple years ago. Mm. Everyone loses trust in your brand, your share price falls, people stop using your product. You're fucked. So I think it's really interesting to watch this develop. And then also, to your point of ransoms and stuff, in the future, it's more likely that, you know, let's say you're a terrorist trying to draw attention to yourself, you're going to use technology to cause a problem because you don't necessarily have the resources to start a war or go out attacking people. You don't have an army, but you can attack people where they are weak, which is through their security with their technology. You can steal data. You can use that information. Even worse, when we have artificial intelligence making decisions, whether that's an actual physical thing, like doing some kind of service, or whether it's a program that determines, you know, how to access your bank account, how much money's in your bank account, what grade your kids got at school. Like, people could go...
You're scaring me now.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
You're scaring our listeners as well. Everybody's shit. Everybody.
I'm just saying, stay woke. On that cybersecurity front.
And if you're looking for a career, cybersecurity is the...
Seriously, though, I'm
starting out, like, I would definitely recommend looking
into
it.
I'm surprised how many people do not have... And, like, now we're going into cybersecurity round, but, like, it's kind of important. Like, how many people don't have two-step authorization on their emails?
Yeah, that's nuts.
And their Twitter. Like, guys, seriously, if you're listening and you don't have that, you need to get it.
Yeah, fix up.
We live in a generation where people email themselves really important information. You email yourself a copy of your passport before you fly.
Mm-mm.
Maybe you email yourself your passcode, your PIN codes, whatever. You need to have two-step authorization set up at the very least. If you're running a company, running a startup, have one password.
Yeah, I remember my pops, he got hacked on his email one time, and the people were emailing it as him, essentially, to other people.
Oh, yeah.
Saying, like, yeah, send us this money, blah, 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 blah.
What happened in my friend's agency?
There we go.
So some hackers got into their email system and then basically sent an invoice as the director of the company to the accountant saying, oh, hey, like,
sort this out for
photography
us, you know,
job, £15,000. No, they paid it. Dude, they paid it.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
And if you think about it from the hacker's point of view, if you've got into, like, you know, 50 email accounts and one of them ends up being a payload like that, then it's all worth it, essentially.
Of course.
That's nuts.
Probably like some 12-year-old kid ninja or something.
Oh, my Lord.
But yeah, so anyway, like, get clued up on your logins and your security.
All right, let's is that all our winners and losers, or should we go into our little growth section?
Growth section. Yeah. So one of the things that we always talk about, both as entrepreneurs but then also as mentors to people working full-time in the working world, is asking for more.
Mm.
Which I
suck at this, by the way.
I think we all do.
We could all improve.
So it's something that we can all improve on. I was having a conversation with a friend. She's been working at the company where she's at for a couple of years now. Her job has changed quite a lot. Her salary hasn't. And she was asking me, you know, when's the right time to bring this up? How do I bring it up? We've also spoken about pricing before, like as B2B companies, what we charge companies. So I thought it'd be I thought it'd be valuable to have a conversation around this and share this information with our listeners.
Yeah, let's shoot. I'm gonna let you see the floor because I'm so bad at this. I don't think I'm in a position to kind of inform the people about it.
Okay, well, I'll answer the first question first. When is the right time to ask for more? So yeah. Let's assume you're working in a job. I think when you first sign a contract, you're negotiating based on like how the role's been explained to you.
Yeah.
In terms of the responsibilities that you'll be taking on, it's inevitable that after some period of time, your role will expand and change. Yeah. That's just the nature Feature of business. Creep. If your business is doing well, you know, yeah. It's going to grow. You're going to take on more clients, more projects. I think as soon as that happens is the first time for you to express the fact that your responsibilities have increased and the compensation that you negotiated was for a lesser role.
Mm.
And then that may not be the time that you get the pay rise because companies are subject to their own financial years and their own budgets, etc. But it should definitely be the first time where you speak up about that and say, you know, this is something that I want us both to acknowledge and ideally get that on record. So, you know, if you can have a conversation like that with your manager and say, you know, since I started X months ago, X years ago, I've taken on these additional responsibilities.
But when do you track that? You think a year's a good point to come to that, have that conversation?
So I believe that at least every quarter and ideally every month.
Every quarter?
No, not asking for it. You should be writing down the things that you've achieved.
Yeah, that's real talk. That's a good idea.
So I think like, you know, every quarter, at least, but ideally every month, you write down all the things that you achieved. Now, most companies are going to have a performance review, an annual performance review. In some companies, it might even be quarterly. Like, definitely bring it up at the minimum yearly. But if you're in a startup, which is like growing crazy amounts or, you know, within a company that's growing crazy amounts and you feel that you're now in that position to ask for more, you shouldn't have to wait a year, in my opinion. Because another thing that's important is to remember that, you know, companies are like complex machines. The bigger the company you work in, the harder it's going to be to get a quick answer. Mm. So if you can start having that conversation early, then what you can start doing is like getting your manager on your side. Then your manager needs to talk to their manager. That manager needs to talk to another manager. They need to talk to someone in accounts and finance. There's a whole chain of decision makers that have to all say yes for you to get that desired outcome.
And how do you know what to pitch in terms of how much your salary should increase by? Let's say you're on 30,000 and you feel like, you know what, my role has increased. So do you look at what's going on in the market? Like,
I think that's definitely a big part of it. I think you need to go on websites like Glassdoor.
Yeah, Glassdoor is a good one.
See what people are being paid in your competitors, in your company for the same role. I mean, there's like loads of studies coming out. CheckCrunch have done one recently.
You know what's really weird though? That I've noticed, especially in the UK, when I have had like corporate jobs, nobody wants to tell you how much they're on. Like, I've asked people like, just so that I know that I'm not getting screwed over.
Yeah.
People have been like, can't really ask that.
Yeah.
Which is really weird. I don't understand that. That's, to me personally, that's like, I don't resonate with that kind of mindset. Like, we're all trying to help each other here. And I know there are companies, a lot of startups, Buffer, for example. It's complete transparency.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Where everybody in the company knows how much everybody earns. You know how much the CEO earns. You know how much your superior earns.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm in favor of that kind of complete transparency, but like,
there's a company like that in the UK as well. It's called Grantree and it's run by an amazing female founder, Paulina. And she runs her company as a holocracy, which basically means that every single person is autonomous, the teams come together as they wish, and they're fully transparent, so everyone knows what everybody's earning. I was actually coming at it from the flip side before you said that and thought there are many companies which actually contractually bind you to not discussing your compensation with other employees.
What?
And if, oh yeah, I've worked at companies like that. So if you now go to HR and go, oh, me and Abba do the same job and Abba's earning 5K more than me, I can now get put on notice or disciplinary action.
That is literally like, it's so transparent that they don't want you to have any leverage over them. That's literally like, in the contract it says, do not have any leverage over us. Like, that's, I can't believe it. I'm stunned.
Really?
I wouldn't accept that if I was working in a place of...
I mean, you can understand why they do it. The reason why...
But it's so transparent that they're just doing that just to...
Pay people screw as over. Little as possible.
Yeah, it's not even... They're not even hiding it.
Of course.
Yo, you... Wow.
Yeah.
That's some bullshit.
But definitely doing research to find out what your going market rate is good. Another thing that I think people should do more as well is like actually work out your budget. And I don't just mean your basic survival budget. I mean your ideal budget. So like how much you're paying on rent, bills, travel, gym, etc. Caviar, champagne.
I've got to throw that in there just in case people are at home thinking, yeah, my budget is once a week. I need
seriously though, savings. True. Like how much do you want to save? Like you're saving for a mortgage, you're saving for a car, whatever. And then when you know what that amount is, be like, okay, then you go on the tax calculator of where you live and you say, if I want to earn this every month, this is how much I need to earn before tax. This equates to this annual salary. And you use that because that gives you the confidence to ask for more. Because when people are like, oh, well, you know, this, this and that excuse, which of course they're going to give you because they're trying to protect as much profit for the company as possible, you can say, well, hey, here's the reality. Inflation's on the up. My rent is on the up.
Yeah.
Everything's on the up. And I'm X years old trying to get a car, a house or whatever, provide for my family. And this is how much you need to do it.
This is it kind of thing.
So it's good to also have that data to help drive that conversation.
I think that's a really good idea. The inflation thing is crazy as well because I haven't had a, you know, full-time job for a while doing this founder thing. But the fact that if your salary doesn't increase year on year, you're getting screwed. It's facts. Just of purely course. On inflation. Like, so in your experience, when you were working kind of corporate world, Amazon, whatever, was that factored in where every year you'd get at least some bump, or was it possible that you could stay stack?
Yeah.
If you didn't ask for it.
I think every company I worked at, I always had a pay rise every year. I mean, it was also tied to performance. So like at Amazon, I had my annual review, I had a pay rise and I had an increase in my equity.
Did people not get the pay rise if they were fucking up?
I think the only people who didn't get pay rises were probably people who were in the process of being managed out.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah.
That makes sense.
So, no, like, it was pretty generous. And again, you know, this is something as well that historically, and if you look at the evidence, men tend to do more than women. Like, men will, like, ask for more. Women just don't feel comfortable. It's kind of awkward, or they get talked out of it. I had a friend recently who was trying to ask for a pay rise, and her boss literally just, like, guilt-tripped her out of it, being like, oh, you know, like, we've got to focus on these things. Can't afford it, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, he's looking out for number one, but you're not looking out for yourself.
Yeah, they make you feel guilty. Just looking out for your own interest.
So the thing that I would say is, like, if that resonates with you, where you want to ask for more, but you feel guilty, or the company's doing this, doing that, whatever, just remember that.
That is the downside, though, of working in a smaller company, in the sense that there may be a situation where the founder is like, we've raised money and we're running out of money, or it's not as profitable as it used to be, and you get sucked into this whole we're a family thing, which we talked about, which I think is complete bullshit. And I say this as somebody who runs his own company, like I would never have that philosophy running through the company, that, yeah, you may feel like you're not in a position to ask for more, or when you do and they come with that guilt trip of like, we're not doing as much as we were, it's difficult right now. What do you do in that situation? Am I fair to classify that as that can be one of the downsides of working for a small business? Or do you think no matter where you work, you should hold the line and say, no, like I deserve this, I want this?
I mean, the answer to that question is it depends. It depends. Like, there isn't a black and white rule. But what I would say is, if that company was transparent with the data, I'd feel a lot more comfortable into falling into that line of argument.
That's true.
So I would want to be like, okay, cool. Yeah, let me see those financials. Let me see. No, but seriously, though, I would.
Because I'd be like,
oh, like, so this is like the reason why I can't get paid more.
Let me see the figs.
You know, I think, you know, I've always been very close to the numbers in previous roles because I've always been in business development. So I know how much money is coming in because I'm contributing to that. And I know how much we're burning because that's also important. You know, that's P&L, profit and loss. But even if you're not in a sales role or whatever role, you should still ask for that information if you're in a small business.
And the weird thing is actually...
All the more reason to have that information in
that. Yeah, it's true. And actually, to be honest, if you work in the UK, you can just go on company's house and get the actual profitability of the company and see what's their P&L statement saying. But hopefully it won't come to that. This is like some real espionage shit, like where you're doing detective work on your own company where it shouldn't have to be that kind of environment.
What about raising prices as an entrepreneur?
I was going to mention that. So something that I can relate to in this situation is sometimes you might have a product or you might have a service and you just charge too little for it because you haven't got the self-confidence to actually think that what you're doing is worth it. Like, and I actually spoke with Abba maybe about 2 months ago, and, you know, she kind of essentially consulted me about raising the prices on pocketjobs.com, which is our job marketplace, essentially. And I was, like, grossly underpricing us compared to what other people were doing.
Yeah.
Just compared to generic job boards, compared to other people that are in our similar space. And it was just purely out of a lack of confidence. And I was concerned that, listen, if we charge more, people are going to go away. They're going to, you know, they're not going to be on it. And what actually happened is I raised prices and we got more customers.
See?
Which is ridiculous. Like,
well, so because price is also a signal
of quality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So if you're too cheap, people start thinking, this maybe this ain't all that.
Exactly.
Maybe this isn't all that kind of thing.
Suspiciously cheap is a thing.
And I've noticed it. Like, for example, my uncle, who, you know, immigrant guy. Like he's an immigrant guy. He migrated here not that long ago, and he's a tailor essentially. Does amazing tailoring work, and he works in Kingston, like in the suburbs, where there's a lot of rich people, and he charges so little that even his customers are like, I feel bad even using your service. And I've said to him, raise the price, and he just won't do it because he doesn't have the confidence. So wherever that comes from, whether that's, you know, if you're a person of color, or whether you're a woman or whatever, like, just charge more. Just see what happens, especially if you're running a startup. The worst that happens is that you can just go back to your original prices.
Yeah.
That's the worst that can happen. Or what you can do is your new customers, you charge a certain price. Your original customers, you keep them at the original price.
Yeah.
And do that, like, and I'm so grateful for that convo that me and you had, because it really helped.
I found that in the entrepreneur world, people are very open to discuss like costs and prices.
Yeah.
When Hustle Crew first began, we provided coaching, and I would just reach out to people who are already doing coaching, personal development training, whatever. And people are very open. Oh, this is how much I charge for an hour. This is how much I charge for a workshop. So if you haven't done that research yet, go ahead and do it. And if people aren't open to giving it to you, you can pretend to be a customer and get it that way. But make sure that you're not coming in at the lowest part of the market, because at the end of the day, you need to survive.
Of course. But the thing is, I think when you're not as confident and you're new to something, what do you think you could compete on? Because you don't think you can compete on the service. So you think, only thing I can compete on is price. Let me undercut them. And it's a road to nowhere, really.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to have a profitable business. You're going to struggle.
Yeah.
And then you're going to give up because you're not making any money, essentially. Well, or you're going to be overworked, especially if you're doing a service, if you're doing like web design or whatever. Yeah. Like, you're going to actually resent your customers. And you're going to not give a good service. And in the end, it's a wrap. And the kind of customers that you get that want cheap, they're not fun to work with.
No.
They're the ones that complain. Ironically, the people that pay the most are the least likely to complain.
Yes.
Obviously, because they probably got high disposable income.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's an irony. Like, and it took me a long time to realize that, where the people that are the ones that are... I mean, If I've worked in retail, my least favorite day was sales day.
Because people
are like, oh, can I get this bit further off? And, you know,
the misers.
Yeah. Like, and I'm not dissing that. Obviously, you know, if you got penny pinch, but not at my expense if I'm running my business, basically. Definitely, if you're a founder, have the confidence to charge what you're worth.
Exactly. And don't forget that you can do A/B testing.
Yeah.
So you can just, you know, direct half your traffic to one page, the other half to another, and just test different prices. There's a lot of great resources around there.
Yeah, so I think that's it, really. Is there anything you want to plug or shout out?
I want to shout out your website, peopleofcolorinterview.com.
Oh, thank you so much. You can't do that, though. Come on.
Why? It's great. I like reading the interviews.
I'll shout my stuff out. It's all right, man. I don't need any help.
Okay,
cool then. I will shout out.
I don't need your help.
I will shout out Hustle Crew.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I'll shout out the consultancy that Abba did for me on the house. That helped me so much. Like, and are you open for consultancy work?
No, I'm not, actually. Only special people.
Okay. Well, if you're a special person, give Abba a shout. If you're not special, fall back. You see what I'm saying? By special, we mean rich. I'm joking.
Subscribe on iTunes. Follow us on SoundCloud. Yes. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, share it with at least 5 friends.
Yeah, please. We need as many reviews as possible on iTunes. That will give us a big hand.
Please, if you're on Twitter, give us your feedback. How did today's episode make you feel? What are things you want us to talk about? Who are guests that you'd love to see on the show? Tweet us, hashtag techish. Can't wait to hear from you guys.
Yeah, use the hashtag, please. And yeah, all right. Ciao.
Bye.
Bye. Peace out.